Hello and welcome to the Primal MMA Coaching Podcast, an exploration of the training and development within mixed martial arts. My name is Scott Siverite, and together with my guests, we will discuss how the science of coaching, ecological psychology, and skill acquisition can help us design practice more effectively. No matter what your martial art goals are, surely we all want to be better. So let's try to be better at getting better. Okay, well, today I am joined by returning guests Sean Mishka and Tyler Yearby to discuss their recently published journal article, Applying an Ecological Dynamics Framework to Mixed Martial Arts Training. Both Tyler and Sean, through their online educational platform Emergence, have been at the forefront in recent years in bringing awareness to and educating about ecological dynamics in sport, specifically in American football, where both work with NFL athletes. Now, while football might be considered their main sport of interest, they have in recent years been increasingly drawn towards MMA, not just as fans, but as you'll hear them talk about, the unique and highly complex dynamic nature of the sport. In our discussion, Sean and Tyler talk about what they hope the paper would offer practitioners and their hopes of this being perhaps the first of many papers that investigate the approach in the sport of MMA. This paper also followed on nicely from their 2023 paper, which was called Reconceptualizing Movement Behavior in Sport as a Problem-Solving Activity, which I think is actually probably worth having a look at first. I've linked both of these papers, which are open access, in the poddy description, where you can download and read them for free. Now, for those of you that have already been reading and learning about the approach and the research supporting it, you may also notice that these papers were co-authored and supported by Professor Keith Davids, who is a leading expert and pioneer of ecological dynamics. I want to thank both Sean and Tyler for being very supportive in my own investigations and learning, and since I connected with them several years ago, they've always been very, very kind and generous with their time, and have always been there to help me better understand areas of the approach when I get stuck. This was also an opportunity to get a glimpse into the process and the work that goes into getting one of these papers written, reviewed and accepted, as myself, Coach Andy Gran and Adam Singer each had our own modest contributions to the paper by way of our own individual case studies. So congrats too to Andy and Adam. I guess we're academics now. Well, speaking of academics, I do have some great guests lined up that I look forward to chatting with, including Rob Gray again, who agreed to come on and talk about his new up-and-coming book. Anyway, as always, thanks to all those who take the time to listen, especially those who take the time to reach out. It is these messages that keep me wanting to do more interviews and grow this network of curious coaches. Now then, my chat with Sean and Tyler. All right, listener or listeners, please welcome my younger big brothers, Sean Mishka, Tyler Yearby. How are you, boys?
My friend, living the dream. And you're looking young and spry yourself, my friend. Every time I see you, you just get a little younger looking, at least.
I think he's speaking to you, Tyler.
Oh, man. I don't know about that, but I might be the youngest one on this call. I'm not sure, but I am north of 40. But I'm doing wonderful to answer your question. I appreciate you having me on, my friend.
Well, we put this together because congratulations to you both that you recently had the paper published, your second one, I believe, in this area of applying an ecological dynamics framework to mixed martial arts training. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today.
I'm looking forward to it. And it is our second as far as an applied paper, very much an applied paper here. And that was the intention, which is why we start the name of the paper with applying in both the American football paper and this mixed martial arts paper as well. But we have had four published in the past couple of years, but certainly these two are intended for practitioners and coaches that are out there because we want to ensure that there's a tight link between the theory and specifically a contemporary approach to skill acquisition and practice. That way coaches can utilize constraints or manipulate them purposely. They can design representative and live learning environments. And so, yes, that is the goal of the papers is to make it very much of a transfer into practice.
And before we, I'm not going to let you off the hook there, Scott. I'm going to offer the congratulations and kudos back to you as well, because you were giving Tyler and I a little bit too much credit there without giving yourself a pat on the back. So we certainly couldn't have done it without you, as well as both Andy and Adam as well. And then Keith, for that matter, too. So credit given to you as well, buddy, because you obviously brought something unique, special, and authentic to the paper. And we certainly 100% want to recognize and appreciate that.
And I will say that even one of the reviewers commented on your case example, how one of their favorite applied areas within the paper was the warm-up portion that was described and what's being utilized there at Primal. So kudos to you, because that really resonated for them. I think that's an easy starting place for practitioners out there within mixed martial arts that maybe are a little bit hesitant to adopt some of the ideas, is just maybe sprinkle some in into the learning environment early on during the movement prep or the warm-up. So kudos to you, and greatly appreciate your contributions to the paper.
Well, thank you. And as I said, depending on who I'm talking to, my level of participation moves up and down. And I'd like to get back to that whole warm-up thing later on in the call. But tell me a little bit, why did we pick MMA? I know Sean specifically, Tyler too, a bit more in the American football realm. Sean, you're a big MMA geek. You're shite at picking winners, but you know a lot about the sport. So tell me why this was the direction you wanted to go in.
Yeah, and thank you for making sure that you drew attention there to our American football experience. And that's obviously where our understanding has grown and evolved and really been developed, especially with applying an ecological approach. Of course, I've been working with National Football League players for the last 15 years or so, since 2007, 2008. And so because of that's why we started with the American football paper. The reason why MMA began to be that path or led to that next step in the journey was because as we found our way with incorporating these ideas, we started to find that people like yourself, Scott, as well as in many across mixed martial arts, were much more willing to adopt the ideas and the concepts. They were seeing the relevance of a high practical application in across their own learning environments. They were, many of the messages, whether some of the things that Tyler mentioned, information movement coupling, keeping the performer or athlete environment relationship intact or intertwined and interwoven within the learning environment, aliveness, representative task design, constraint manipulation, the guidance and communication piece. Many of the ideas and concepts at Ecological Dynamics was offering as the way forward as a framework were resonating really closely and really nicely for most coaches, as well as athletes, just any MMA practitioner. It was resonating so much for that group and that this niche that we see this huge influx of people who are actually willing to put the ideas to the test. And I think there's something there that we should all aspire to. I wish American football coaches would do something similar as MMA coaches are.
I concur, Sean, and I can summarize my interest in wanting to put this paper together with y'all in really probably three easy ways. Number one, I'm just a fan of the sport. I think it's extraordinarily exciting to watch the intricacies of it, the unfolding nature of how dynamic MMA is in particular, and then certainly the different disciplines in martial arts. Number two, and this doesn't come as any surprise to any of the listeners who know me or shouldn't come as a surprise, is I'm a huge fan of Bruce Lee. And I was turned on to Bruce Lee, I mean, knew about him, of course, but I was turned on to him more so by Sean because we've known each other for a long time. He's like, I'm like, gosh, you keep mentioning this guy. Well, I'll start diving into his works and the Tao Jeet Kune Do from 1975, which was obviously published then, but it was something that he was adopting and utilizing part of the point. And the notion of aliveness was mentioned a lot in there, which is where the idea came from, where it originated, the idea of alive or aliveness, which we then reconceptualized later on or built out more so into alive movement problem solving, where constraints are purposely manipulated. So that's kind of the tying together of the Tao Jeet Kune Do and ecological dynamics and some of the underpinning ideas of nonlinear pedagogy. And for those of you that are unfamiliar, definitely pick up our Being Water paper. But that's where a lot of this started. It was the excitement of, wow, this is being discussed and has been discussed for decades within martial arts. And in particular, with the work of Bruce Lee and the Tao of Jeet Kune Do and the notion of aliveness, which is obviously, like I said, where it started. And so for me, it was like, well, then not only being a fan and then realizing that these ideas have been espoused within the sport for quite some time, maybe I should look at the sport itself with more of my movement analysis lens. So then as I started truly watching the sport from more than just maybe a beer on the weekend as I'm watching the UFC or something, I realized that this was a perfect opportunity to delineate what affordances are and the emerging decaying opportunities for action. It is one of the best sports, if not the best, in being able to discuss deception and how one may move in ways to draw out behavior of another and what that can mean for training camps and practice environments or training sessions rather for mixed martial arts. So it became a great sport for myself and Sean to not only love as fans, but to utilize as an example of all the great practitioners and what they're doing already. And then maybe some things that can be slightly tweaked to make the sport and the coaches that are working with the athletes even better. So those are probably the three main areas that inspired me to want to lead this paper.
Great. Now, I know we're already in talks, you guys are already in thoughts and discussions about where do we go from here next. Before we do that, are you able to talk to the challenges of really studying an ecological approach? Because we're studying learners in their environments and the challenges that has compared with perhaps more lab settings and how science in sports has typically been done?
I'll certainly start here, and then I definitely want Tyler to come in on this as well. I think first and foremost, just for those listeners that might be new to ecological dynamics or readers of the paper who maybe weren't all that well versed on some of the concepts which underpin ecological dynamics, let's remember that first and foremost, the scope and scale of analysis for someone who is informed by an ecological dynamics framework or approach would be fixated or focused on the performer-environment relationship. So that is our only relevant scope and scale of analysis. So that tells us something right there. The aliveness of that mutual reciprocal exchange between a fighter and everything that the cage encompasses. This is why we talked about or attempted to unpack this and convey it through this idea of the fighter-cage system. And we don't want people to misconstrue that. So we certainly want you to dive into the paper so you can see that cage and fighter system ends up being an all-encompassing one. The ref, the rules, the crowd, the coaches, the judges, the pressure, the anxiety, the fatigue, all of these types of things coming to be as this fighter cage system. And it's there, Scott, that we actually find the difficulty in applying an ecological dynamics oriented study, because there's no two problems that are ever going to be the same. We never step in the same river twice, for we're not the same man and the river's not the same either, right? And so for this, if no two problems are ever the same, like these exchanges of information, the opportunities that are going to be present based on our opponent, our changing opponent, and the changing moments in time, across situations and across conditions, there will never be another instance exactly like it. And so it makes it difficult to study, right? If we respect that performer-environment relationship as our main starting point to springboard off of, it tells us like, well, that might only be relevant, that which what we're witnessing and analyzing and assessing might only be relevant right now at this time. And that adds a great degree of complexity. There's other layers there, numerous interacting component parts. But once we begin there, we can finally start to study the relationships, the interactions, because it's those things that make any behavior that we're witnessing or attempting to facilitate more of, or at least facilitate more functional behavior as a coach or a practitioner. That's what makes it truly relevant, but it's also what makes it so damn difficult as well.
And just building on Deshaun's response there, that's where we start looking into the similarities of the unfolding movement problems as far as us as a practitioner. And I'm speaking on behalf of the practitioners out there because I'm just a participant in mixed martial arts and then obviously a keen observer of the unfolding nature of the sport itself. But I think that's where we start to look at the similarities of problems and we look to who the individual may be fighting next. And then we need to dive into what we have as far as any footage of them potentially being able to observe them in person to see the nuances and maybe ways in which they may attack similar problems. And it may be the interpersonal distance between the two fighters. It may be the relationship to the cage. It may be the intentions of the fighter we're fighting to try to get us to the ground on a regular basis. And then our job as practitioners, or rather your job and others, Adams and Andy's and others, your job is to create a slice of that sport in a safe way that allows for exploration. But it's the process of trying to repeat the solving of similar behaving problems, to borrow from Nikolai Bernstein. And we're working through maybe mistakes, ways in which that weren't functional, ways in which were functional. But in doing so, and this is where the value is, we can become sensitive to the way in which that particular fighter that's mimicking, if you will, or moving in a similar way, how they behave, some of the velocities at which they move. That way we can start to calibrate our actions to that information. And to really give you a glimpse of the meaningfulness of this and how powerful slices of the sport itself or the activity or the training session need to be in order to represent what could be in the cage is, if you think about UFC 299 that just unfolded, and you think about any of the fighters in the first couple of minutes of early rounds, there's this kind of measuring, if you will. They're calibrating their movement system to the information that they're perceiving. And in my humble opinion, the really quality camps that have either mistakenly stumbled into some alive slices that are varying in complexity of the sport or doing it purposefully, because there are some out there their fighters are able to calibrate that information much quicker, because even though it's a little bit different because it's the actual fighter versus one that was simulated to move in ways that were going to be close to them, that's how they can start to land strikes more efficiently. They can secure takedowns more effectively, and they can close that gap, if you will, and harness brinkmanship.
Thank you for that. So we're going to get into this today. Do you think there's clearly a growing thirst in the community for maybe this new kind of approach? Here's something I've identified here. I think that perhaps we'll so-called call it the traditional approach so far. We've been very much focused. Coaches have always manipulated the tasks, right? That's generally what coaching has been. But I would imagine it's generally been focused on the task and the individual. Now there's this rush to change and manipulate the environment. I think there's a danger that we then forget about the uniqueness of the learner themselves. Can you talk a little bit about that, why this kind of triad, this has to be wholly integrated at all times?
Yeah, and of course, we're probably going to give a number of hat tips here to Bruce Lee throughout, but one of the things that I led, or I guess was led to Bruce Lee's work in Jeet Kune Do early on, was to use no way as the way, where the individual would be the honest, authentically creating individual, right? And so the individual still had a spotlight on them, how that individual saw the world. And that was something that we wanted to speak to in the paper. So readers, I definitely would implore you to go check it out a little bit further. But this idea of one's form of life, how someone sees the world, how someone attempts to behave within it based on their exposures and their experiences in life as a whole, but also in the octagon or in a martial arts academy, right? Like, we want to harness and then aim to leverage that form of life so they can become that honest, creative, authentic individual who's able to express themselves through their movement, behavior, and their skill. And I think it's there, Scott, that we want to continue to maintain the real interdependence between those constraint areas, between the organism, the task, and the environment, and how they coalesce together to become one in the moment. And so you can't neglect or forget the individual just because you begin to focus more on the manipulation of constraints oriented around either the task or the environment. But there are things that we can do to still give that individual the room and space to go and grow in their own way, so they're able to search and discover and ultimately exploit the opportunities that are present from those coalescing constraints. And I think it's there that we must remember that each individual is their own authentic one. You mentioned, obviously, the traditional approach or a traditional way of viewing things. Oftentimes, rote repetition, as well as a technical model or a rehearsal of a specific way that we want to aspire to be more expert oriented in the way that we might be executing any sort of technique. We want to reframe this idea of what skill is. Skill is about this adaptive functional relationship between oneself and this problem. The what is, as Bruce Lee would say, the what is what we're attempting to become more attuned and sensitive to. It's what we're attempting to be more open, responsive, and ultimately intentional around. And finally, to be adaptable alongside of, to have a functional relationship with that problem. And that's why I think it's important for us as coaching practitioners to guard the athletes that we work with from our own biases, from our own way of viewing the world. That's why we pointed to certain individuals in the paper. Israel Adesanya, obviously, in The Last Style Bender, like his idea that he wants to be water-like in adapting to the opponent that he's facing, right? And you and I did, obviously, a podcast after he lost to Strickland about how he wasn't able to do that under those constraints. We brought up Khabib Nurmagomedov in there. We brought up Islam Makhachev in there. And just the way that they have been grown through social and cultural factors as well, that leads to their authentic fighting form of life. So it should still be centralized in this approach, even if we are investigating the problems with as much respect as we do the individual or the environment as a whole.
I always love hearing Sean talk about that, so I'm glad that you went a little bit longer. I'll just add maybe one or two things to it. First thing being, if we think about the constraints model that was conceptualized by Carl Newell back in the 80s and likely developed earlier before that time frame, it is a triangle, and it doesn't eliminate the individual and just focus on the task and the environment. It's always the three that are intertwined together. So I think if we look back to even the constraints model that gave rise to the constraints-led approach and the pedagogy that's then used by coaches that are harnessing an ecological approach, we have to understand that we want there to be a symmetrical relationship and that we don't want to neglect the individual and their unique differences, which leads me to the form of life piece. And I'll use a specific example from one of the last fights. And I'm a fan of Dustin Poirier, the Diamond. I like watching him. I like his style of fighting. It's partly because I'm from Texas. And my mom is from Louisiana, and that's where he was born, in Lafayette area. I know he trains sometimes out of Florida, but he's from the South. And for those of you who haven't been to Louisiana, it's a very, very challenging place. It can be to live anyways with a Southern type mentality, but even more so different than other areas of the South. And I mentioned that because you can see it in his fighting style, his entire behavior. And I know there's an example that could be given that would be the direct opposite of why maybe you might not want to jump guillotine sometimes. But he's told right away, he's being told by his coaches, don't do this. Well, the opportunity to do it was there. Now, maybe he didn't secure it for a victory there, but you can't tell me it didn't wear the opponent down. You can't tell me that it didn't open up other opportunities for him to strike, which obviously it did, which is how he won. So I only say that because his form of life is to be uniquely himself, to be a bit gritty, to attack in ways in which are going to be maybe, I guess, in some ways electric as far as like trying to choke someone out in that aggressive way. But that's his style. That's his form of life. We want to promote that as coaches to a certain extent, unless we're seeing there be lots of failure there to where we want to nudge that athlete away from that solution. That's where we might want to try to destabilize that in setting up him to fight against someone that is a really good grappler. That way he doesn't have the opportunity to jump guillotine as often. And I say that only because far too often coaches want to gravitate towards guiding an athlete to their solution or their solutions that they have identified. And from an ecological perspective, we view the world and in the affordances based on our individual capabilities. And so not your capabilities, not Sean's, but their capabilities. So clearly in this situation, Dustin perceived an opportunity, multiple actually, of jumping guillotine. So he did just that, which I think led to him being able to win that fight, amongst other things, of course, but him being able to win that fight. So I just want to utilize that as a clear example of why we want to harness someone's form of life and then utilize that to develop a better fighter.
Okay, thanks for that. I think the reason that probably maybe now two things there. If he'd pulled the guillotine off, we'd all be celebrating, for his coaches would have been celebrating that. I think the fact that if he's failing at it, he's ending up on bottom is probably what the coaches were cautioning against. My jumping back here, my little contribution to the paper was on the initial stage, right? The foundation stage, which I'm really passionate about. I think most coaches can get on board. Liveliness, the representativeness is a good thing, and it's part and parcel of all good camps. The fact that we are advocating for this approach and being live and unscripted right from day one. So the general or the overwhelming pushback I get is, well, okay, we can move on to this after we've got the basics down and the fundamentals. You've heard that across every sport. Can you just speak to why it's not that we're being overzealous or zealots about it. It's more that we're being logically coherent. We're saying, listen, this is the way we understand skill development, and it doesn't make any sense to come at it after we've laid down these fundamentals. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because this is one of the main pushbacks that we get. This is all very good. This is all great, but we need to get this foundational movements down, these fundamentals, so to speak.
I'm already unmuted here, so I'll jump in. Scott, I don't care if this is your podcast or not. Don't talk to me about fundamentals. I'm just kidding. I say that in a joking way simply because I was a believer in that early on as well for nearly a decade. It was like I needed to teach the athletes I was working with in football this perfect technique to sprint, and come to find out that they rarely hit top end speed. And so the figure four positions we were hitting weren't overly valuable because their position didn't require them to either be there, or if they were even close to that, they were actually bending and turning and they were trying to pick up a ball or another moving target. So it wasn't overly helpful. Pause it if you're listening to this after the fact, of course, and think about what that means in your sport. Technique is changing. It's linked to information. And it's not to mean that a coach can't say or can't provide some explicit guidance, such as like, we're working on this particular hold. But to say it has to be done in one way and to blow it dead, basically, if they don't execute it in that way, I think is a detriment to a learner that's learning to learn to move, to borrow from other scientists. Like, we're learning to learn to adapt. And I think that the notion of like being able to have some messiness within learning is something that coaches need to embrace. And there may be similarities to the way in which a solution is organized. And so that's why I say it's okay, I think, in some ways, if a coach is like, have you tried this? Or what have you noticed about this? I think questions can be very powerful there after they may have said it could look something like this. You're not saying that it has to be that, or you're wrong if you don't, or I'm going to stop the actual rolling itself if it's BJJ, if you don't do it in this way, but they're attempting to find a functional fit with that particular hole. But the way in which they execute it, if you will, is going to be different each time because of the height, the body weight, the skill level of that individual, the fatigue that's present. I mean, if you think about that, I'm unpacking the constraints and how they shape the behavior. So let's say, and I'll give you one specific example here of maybe a way that it can be designed that allows for that athlete to then become more sensitive and better at executing, if you will, that technique. And then I'll let Sean unpack this. But let's say that you have tried to teach a particular hold for any grappling type situation, and you've always taught it in a very fresh state with your athletes, and then they find themselves fatigued pretty quickly. Why not have them fatigued and then start to work through that process of trying to find that particular hold in a really fatigued state, or potentially whenever they're rolling with someone like myself, who's a professional sweater, and they're hard to grasp because of that. So I think it's there where if we can look at where our athletes' rate limiters are, and maybe it's in a fatigue state with certain grips, that's where we want to immerse them in more often than not, even with a little bit of sprinkled in explicit guidance, if you will, instruction, and then let them figure some things out. And yes, I do mean figure some things out, and do it in a safe way to where that's the time where they actually should be able to do it, versus it being the first time they're encountering it is whenever they're in the cage with someone who's equally as talented as them.
Let's not forget that the highest technique is to have no technique. My technique is a result of another's technique. My movement is a result of somebody else's movement. That, to me, in an octagon, in a fight, is the fundamental. That's the fundamental truth. There's an opponent who is offering an opportunities, challenges, perturbations, right? These are affordances, aka opportunities to act, per J.J. Gibson, 79, and has been later, obviously, on a whole heck of a lot, including in our paper. It's connecting our movement behaviors in relation to those opportunities to act, or then the threats or the perturbations, the challenges that we might have to find a resolution around. And so I think it's there that we begin to reframe this conversation about what really is fundamental, what really is the basics, what really are those things that we must do. And right from the start, when we're talking about someone being in a fight, what someone must do is solve an alive movement problem that is represented based on oneself and their behaviors in relation to another. And so I think it's there that we begin to have a different conversation about what really are the basics, what really are the things that we need to include, to have slices and snippets of. It isn't the technique, like Tyler mentioned. The technique emerges in response to the problem. And so for us, that's why we feel as though beginners, or those at a more foundational level, or even those that might be moving through the time scales of learning, should always reorient themselves back to those basics, or back to those foundational fundamentals. It's one of the things that I think you're seeing, Scott, with your individuals that are relatively new or have a relatively wide landscape of where they can go and how they might go there. By introducing martial arts situations right off the bat, you're presenting problems to them. And therefore, yes, there's going to be unpredictability. There's going to be indeterminacy. And they are going to Tyler's point, have to figure some shit out on their own. That's okay. We actually allow them in that process to be facilitated. Like Tyler mentioned earlier when he pointed to Bernstein, it's this repeating of the process of solving problems, again, and adjusting the techniques in relation to said problem. And when we say techniques, it's not just a motor action technique, but it's in our perceptions and our cognitions as well. It's in what we're looking at, when we're looking at it, what it might mean, and how it perpetually flows into our intentional aims to act in a given way, the thoughts we might think, the decisions we might make, and ultimately then how we carry those actions out. That's why we wanted to present this idea from the problem solver paradigm being about this integrated, intertwined, interwoven movement problem solving process. It isn't about the action. The actions themselves are just a byproduct and an expression of what we're perceiving and what we might be thinking and making decisions around.
Yeah, I love that last point. So you really did answer it there. And I don't use the word fundamentals now, or I try to avoid it.
I'm just giving you a hard time, Scott.
No, it doesn't mean much to me. So I do use foundational skills as something I'm trying to develop. Let me narrow that down a little bit then. Again, because I'm just trying to bring to you some of the pushbacks that is coming from a community. Another one I'm seeing now, we all have to start somewhere. I probably made the same mistake many times over myself. We say, okay, well, let's have this ecological part of the class, and then we'll stick to the old kind of IP prescriptive method. Again, can you speak to why it's not a case for us being zealous about what we believe in? It just doesn't make sense. They're incompatible underlying assumptions.
Yeah, it's a really slippery slope to stand on. And I encourage those who are on that slope to get off immediately. And the reason why I say that, I've been very fortunate that I have made a lot of mistakes in my coaching career. And I've had athletes that I trust and believe in that I've partnered with, because I do believe in leaning into the athletes and their experiences. And I'll give the example, a good friend of mine, and he's someone I've been working with for a long time. And we were training together, and we'd probably been together for at that point for nearly 2 or 3 years. And I was in the early stages of transitioning from a traditional model to an ecological approach. And what I mean by traditional model, just traditionalist type coaching, where it was very explicit, very rote, a lot of times isolated. I was expecting them to carry out something that I had identified as the correct technique. And we had been together for a bit, and I was probably at that time, in a lot of places that those on the call that are listening are, I was like, I'm going to be this person over here, and over here, I'm going to be this person. And maybe that's not the way that you that are listening are conceptualizing what you're doing, but that's what you're like literally two different coaches. And so we're in the midst of the warm up. And I do mean like warm up. We're trying to hit perfect models of movement within sprinting technique because he's a receiver, still plays professional level. And I was coaching him exactly where he needed to be, telling him that he was in a wrong place here and there. He needed to move faster to be correct, so on and so forth. We were working on footwork, working on technical speed. We got finished with that, dust our hands off. Now we're going to move to the alive movement problem solving. At the time, I was just calling it problem solving. And he's like, bro, Tyler, you just told me to do XYZ over here. And now you're telling me to explore over here. Which one do you want me to do? Because it's really hard for me because I'm not exactly sure what I should be doing. It changes the way in which I'm attempting to act within the problem. That wasn't exactly what he said, basically what he said. And I stopped and I'll never forget it. It was 2016. And I'm like, oh man, this is not a good situation to be in, because regardless of what you may think, whenever you speak, you're shaping the way the athlete or the individual interacts with the world, because your communication with them is a constraint. It is educating their attention, where their perception perceived. It is educating their cognition, or in this particular situation, their intentions and how those may unfold in said activity. And I realized,
just lost you there on the audio, Tyler. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep. You're back on now. I can edit that out. I'm sorry.
Okay, so what I'll say is I think we may have cut out there, then I'll pick back up and you can splice them. I don't care if it's not perfect, but obviously cutting out this middle bit. So I think we may have cut out there for a second, but point being is that I was being one person in one place and another person in another place. And the athlete identified how challenging that was for them because it was changing where their attention was educated. It was changing the intentions that they had and how those intentions were unfolding. And what it was doing is it was changing their search. And I realized right away, like, wow, this can be powerful because I could educate their search to an area that we've collectively identified that might be beneficial, but it can also be really detrimental to their learning, because as we're searching, we're picking up nuances, specifying information such as velocities or angles or deceptive type movements. So just think about what that means for your practice. Those of you that are listening, when you speak, you're shaping their intentions and potentially their attention, not always, but likely. And then how can you harness that to use that for good? That's B. And C, and probably most importantly, and I implore you, even if you don't like me saying this, get off of that slippery slope. It's a detriment to your learners. If not one over here and one over there, you're either adopting a contemporary approach or you're adopting a traditional approach. And I'm not saying you have to adopt a contemporary approach, but if you're adopting both, the athletes themselves will tell you that, and it hurts them.
Yeah. And I think if we really begin to think about this problem solver paradigm, if you will, highly informed from an ecological dynamics rationale or viewpoint or vantage point, again, it's about maintaining the relationship between the performer environment, mutuality. Again, behavior affords behavior, the opponent, the opportunities in the bigger environment from the octagon and everything that lies beyond that as well. I mean, I think it's here that if you can see the relevance to your coaching, in your practice, as well as then the athletes themselves, you can see why we would not want to separate those items from one another. Now, it doesn't mean that everything has to be cranked up on the representative scale. It doesn't mean that everything has to be so alive that it leads to nothing but a shit show of chaos, indeterminacy, or unpredictability. We can scale that complexity down, scaling the information, if you will, by how we manipulate our constraints to set certain actions maybe to come to be. But I think what we need to recognize that if you can see the relevance of maintaining that performer environment relationship or that fighter cage system, if you begin to see the world through a systems lens and perspective, you're thinking about what you're seeing in the relationships, the interactions, all of a sudden it shouldn't make any sense any longer to go back to that old traditional approach and adopt those old traditional ways of being, to tell athletes exactly how to behave or what positions they might hit, to tell every athlete that they have to execute in this really constrained way of being or behaving. It no longer makes sense. So if the people who are dabbling, and I'm going to call the elephant in the room, saying it depends, depending on the learner, I can use and adopt all these different ideas, that just means that you probably haven't dove deep enough into many of the conceptual frameworks and ideas that ecological dynamics is underpinned by. It's not just the one idea. It's ecological psychology married and matched to systems thinking, complex adaptive systems thinking, and lots of research that comes from it, evolutionary science and the like. These ideas coming together help us to frame our lens of analysis, as well as our lens of being and how we might interact as a coach or as a practitioner. And it lets you do this of many of those old things, even if they might be traditional or, God forbid, dogmatic, that we have to do them. We have to hit these positions, or this expert executes in this way. So that's the thing that we must strive for in the technical execution. I just think that's really disrespecting the system's way of viewing the world to begin with.
I think your last point there made sense, but I think your last point there was powerful. That's what I said. I want to respect this relationship at all times. And we can acknowledge that the fighter themselves is a complex adaptive system, but when you put them in a cage with another opponent, they themselves become a complex adaptive system. So it's not coherent to separate them if we're going to take this approach.
Question that I've had a handful of times, and actually one that was posed just recently, because we put this out that we're going to be recording this podcast. We put it out on X, and then we did on Instagram as well. And a question that was asked by a practitioner, a listener, a learner — we're all learners, of course, all trying to find our own way — was, I read your paper, picked up a number of different things. What are three takeaways? Like, if I need to include three different things within my training sessions, what would they be? And our recommendation, of course, I was like, what would you include based on what you read? But my three personally, and they're all interwoven, so you're going to realize quickly this they're hard to untangle here. Number one being the notion of aliveness, but with purposeful constraint manipulation and varying the complexity. And Sean mentioned this earlier, and I think this is an important point. It doesn't have to be so aligned where it's exactly like the fight's going to be and all of the constraints are at play. It can be only more alive than a sterile dead problem. So it might be we're limiting where strikes can come from. Think about some of the case examples that are used, with one of the ones that Andy actually talked about and how powerful that was, where you're starting in certain ways, or see if you can utilize this or this in order to accomplish this problem. So you're kind of narrowing their search in some way, this being certain holds they may be looking for. So you're still allowing for autonomy, and that kind of moves into my second recommendation, which is like ownership and the ability to make mistakes or find your way. Dr. Carl Woods would talk about the notion of wayfinding, like I'm actually working through the process of solving that problem by kind of meandering sometimes and then having my attention educated in others. And now I'm attempting to search. That's the whole notion of using constraints, or one of the ideas is I'm trying to narrow that search space for them because there's so much information out there. So the notion of aliveness with purposeful constraint manipulation to vary the complexity. And you as professionals know that might mean eliminating head strikes in certain situations, or shortening the length of the time of the round, or having them start in a fatigue state. I talked about some of those earlier. Ownership, autonomy, that idea. And then the other one is representative co-design. I'm a huge proponent of letting the athletes' voices really ring within the design of some of the activities. And maybe this isn't the case necessarily for someone that's brand new, that just walked into the facility and they don't even know which way's up or down. But certainly once someone's been in there a little bit, asking them, hey, what are you picking up on? What do you find yourself challenged by? What situations can we collectively design to where it's going to challenge you or push you towards your challenge point? And then as the coach, we have to keep in mind that we can coach without having to say anything necessarily. We can change the length of the round. We can change the size of the space. We can change the starting point of the problem. So now we're actually starting with contact versus no contact, so on and so forth. So those would probably be the three big takeaways for me. And if you could even just take one of those and maybe inject that within your training, I think you're going to start to see some really cool things happen.
Thanks for that. From a practical perspective, again, and asking maybe for some coaches out there, maybe a rule of thumb, when you're designing a game, okay, I have my own kind of process that I go through and I talk to my coaches about what underpins a good game, the anatomy of a good game. But again, I think, and I spoke about this a lot, when people come maybe across a constraints-led approach and they're buying in and they're trying it, it can seem like we can get to a point where maybe we over-constrain or the task rules and information you're preloading the game with themselves become vastly more confusing than the actual just fucking showing them.
I'm going to let Sean jump in here, but I just want to jump in and say before he adds on here, I still do that sometimes. I still will over-constrain certain situations, and I realize that the solutions that are emerging aren't going to be overly effective in the sport in which they play. So I have to change things. But you have to be willing to kind of drop your guard a little bit. Not, I don't want to take no puns intended there, but like get to like drop your guard a little bit to go, you know what? I don't have it all figured out, and they matter in this process. So I'm going to communicate with them. We're going to figure it out together.
Well, and this is where the question that I think we all need to ask when we watch behavior unfold in the practice environment is sort of our North Star, if you will. Does what's unfolding in the behaviors look, feel, act, and unfold more closely to how it will in a real live fight? When the fight is real and the fighter is in the cage, is what emerging look, feel, acting, and unfolding like it will in the real fight? And if the answer is no, or obviously sometimes there's some gray area, it's not always a black and white yes or no. But in that gray area, then ask yourself, well, what can I manipulate in order to bring more aliveness to this respective practice task? And so I think for me, it's really there that we should probably give that advice to the individual that mentioned to Tyler what his main question was, which was, what are three things? I think for me, I can narrow it down to one thing, which is, does it look, feel, act, and unfold like it will in a real fight? And if the answer is no, then we probably have to start tweaking and adjusting and modifying the constraints, could be any number of them, to open up those types of interactions so they do have ownership, so they can find their own way, if you will, as a learner, to give them that room to search, discover, and exploit their own respective ways of interacting and problem solving within the fighting cage. But I think there, if we just start by asking ourselves the question, we get ourselves a whole heck of a lot closer than where we typically are, especially if we're stuck in this place of rote repetition or this explicit telling or instruction or feedback oriented around how someone might be technically executing.
Thanks for that. And Tyler, that was enormously reassuring because I think, and I wrote it the other day, at least two of my practices per week are complete clusterfucks, no matter how diligently I've planned them. So again, as a coach, as the longer you stay on this, you will learn to turn the knobs and dials to the place that you'll become more sensitive to the room that you're coaching. And nothing screams ecology to me more than that. Yeah. Boys, I don't want to drag you away from the paper we're here to discuss today, but I think it fits in nicely because one of a comment I got was, have we snuck back in cognition in between perception and action? And I wanted to refer you to, because I went back and read your paper. That was your 2023 paper. Go ahead. I've just pulled up the reconceptualizing. Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, reconceptualizing movement behavior in sport as a problem-solving activity.
Okay, so you sent figure one to me, which you think is great. Can you talk a little bit about, I don't know if you have it there, you probably know it off by heart anyway, dexterity, Bernstein, 1996, and talk about the integrated circular loop of perception, cognition, and action.
Yeah,
and so it's not misinterpreted.
Yeah, absolutely. First, you mentioned obviously Bernstein and dexterity, this ability to solve any emerging movement problem in any situation in across conditions, right? And so that is our driver, if you will, in this problem solver paradigm. Now, Bernstein went on to say that dexterity didn't exist in the motor action system degrees of freedom itself. It's not in the motor, but instead it's in the relationship with an alive environment, essentially. And a relationship with an environment that has opportunities and challenges, and that's what it's being presented to us. So Scott and any listeners out there, this problem solver paradigm basically begins to reframe, again, highly informed by ecological dynamics. It reframes movement behavior in sport as a problem solving activity, where the problem solving activities and the movement solutions are going to be integrated ones, where they're intertwined, interwoven relationships between perceptions, cognitions, and actions. The three we are all always doing. We are all always perceiving. We are all always thinking. We are all always acting, right? And so it's not a linear step-by-step process, but instead it's a holistic integrated movement problem-solving process where there's degrees of freedom within and between each one of those dimensional levels or processes of perceptions, cognitions, and actions. And these degrees of freedom then come together and come to be. They become interwoven. They are interdependent with one another. They are always perpetually feeding into one another with tight circular causality, which is something that you mentioned there. Again, it isn't we first perceive and then we think and then we do. It isn't in this linear, more information processing, generalized motor programming perspective that we believe that this problem solving is taking place. And that's what makes this conceptualization a reconceptualized one. We're trying to frame it from an ecological dynamics rationale and perspective. Now, the point that you made as far as cognition is concerned, now this is something that myself and Tyler have mentioned over the years that we feel as though in ecological dynamics, we need to be spending more time around and about, but people like Gibson himself was an ecological psychologist. So for someone to say, well, there's no cognition here, it isn't that there isn't any cognition there. It's just that cognition is proposed to have a different mechanistic way of behaving and coming to be and feeding into the perception and the actions. Sorry, I'm losing my voice a little bit. So the intentions, the decisions, the thoughts, the memories, anything that we would frame as cognitions are going to scaffold perceptions and actions just like the two will to one another already in the way that we typically think, which is we perceive to act and we act to perceive. But the whole point being here is that ecological cognition is embodied, it's embedded. It's the whole integrated movement problem-solving process that the cognition is a piece and a part of. Perception isn't any more important than action, just like cognition isn't any more important than perception and nor action either, right? And I think that's the difference in our paradigm or the way that we view the world here. In the fact, like when we look at information processing, more traditional ways of viewing movement behavior and sport, they would take a very neurocentric view of how cognition would come to place and have a priority and an emphasis, right? We store models, we store programs, ways of doing and being. And so when we interact with the environment in the traditional way of viewing the world, we have to process the heck out of whatever we took from how it is that we were picking up stimuli or relevant cues as to how we might act. But in our view, we are always picking up information. We are in functional contact with the world. And that's why in the paper, our 2023 paper, we positioned cognition with as much emphasis and priority as we did perception and action. But the thing is, Scott, we weren't the first to do that. Obviously, DeWart did it a few years back when his paper, Ecological Cognition in 2019, began to remind people as to how others have thought about it. Individuals like Reed and Turvey, Michaels, Carrillo, others have spoken about the role of cognition, and they never didn't place importance on it, we just said there's some meat on the bone here. We have to continue to think about how and where it might exist. We just happen to hopefully place or shine a little bit more light on it equally to perceptions and actions. But the things that we wanted readers to be able to take from it is that problem-solving activity, that problem-solving process is a highly integrated one that is always intertwined, always interwoven, and it always has this perpetual feeding in from these respective processes of perceptions, cognitions, and actions. Hence the reason the degrees of freedom problem we tried to position as a more holistic, full human movement system degrees of freedom problem, and not one that's taking place in some homunculus in the brain that is like puppeteering, if you will.
Tyler, you might be able to add on to this, because I want to keep going with this cognition part so it's not misinterpreted. And maybe what you think are the classic or the typical assumptions made by many coaches not in the ecological space of what this cognitive part of the development is. Did the question make sense?
I will jump in there, and then hopefully Ty will be able to take.
You can rephrase the question for me, Sean.
Yeah, I guess from my perspective, the way that people see cognition is dependent on how they see perception and action to come to be in the real world as well, right? We believe that behavior is an ecological event. It takes place somewhere at some time, happening in some way, as opposed to those who maybe are more traditionalist with the way that they view the role of cognition to be, in that it is the brain is this thing that is sort of processing the information that is present. There's a big difference there, right? Like in that processing, it's like once it's processed, it's done its job. And it moves on to controlling this action that it found in some sort of Rolodex or movement library or catalog. That's the traditional way of viewing it, that if this, then that, this stimuli, then I behave in this way because I've gone through my Rolodex, process the information to tell me how I need to act. But in an ecological approach, if it's embodied and cognition is embedded, we are embedded in this environment, and the cognition becomes embodied in everything we do. We perceive to act, we act to perceive, but that is scaffolded and linked alongside of our cognitions, our intentionality, the thoughts that we might be thinking. And so this is where this idea, even when we look at Gibson and what he talked about, with a knowledge of or a knowledge within and in, the environment being very different than a knowledge about, such as being that which what was from afar. And so I guess for me, that's the misunderstanding that I see typically being placed here. It isn't that we forgot about cognition. It's just that we were framing its role to be very different than what was traditionally adopted or how someone who might adopt a different approach than us. And that's okay that if somebody views it in that way, but what they're basically implying is that the brain is doing a whole heck of a lot of work and it's being carried out in a very linear process. It isn't, again, it's more of a, we first perceive, then we think about it, and then we find our way to do. And then we come back to that place where we have to pick up more stimuli. And again, process the heck out of it, we perceive, and we think, and then we do again. It's not that in our perspective. The movement problem-solving process in the way that we view the world is a constantly unfolding one, where those degrees of freedom are coming to be based on our functional contact with the world, our openness and responsiveness to it, to remain adaptable in relation with it. But we are never stopped that process at any time. We're kind of all always problem solving. We're all always perceiving, thinking, and doing, if that makes more sense.
That latter point there is, as them not being discrete steps, I think is a clear difference between the two. They're not distinctly different from one another. They're always heavily intertwined. I'll give a highly practical example to unpack what Sean just shared. And I like to think about it from the perspective of two fighters that are toe to toe with one another. And maybe they're in that measuring time frame where they're just started the fight. And during that time frame, I may have the intention of maybe throwing a feint just to see what type of behavior may come out of the individual. But if I'm standing toe to toe and my intentions, which would be part of someone cognizing, my intentions are to throw a feint. As I'm throwing the feint, I am constantly picking up the behavior of the other. And the throwing of the feint is action, of course, but they're all coupled together within one. So I had the intention of throwing a feint and I'm moving, I'm picking up the interpersonal, changing interpersonal distance. I'm picking up the center of mass height of that individual. I'm picking up the extremities and how they may be moving, whether that be up, down, guarding their face, a little closer to the body, the relationship between them and the cage. Like I'm picking up, I'm detecting all of that information. I have these intentions that are flowing. I may have the intention to throw a feint to see what type of behavior comes from the individual. And as I do, their intentions are also coupled there and they intend to shoot. Well, I have rapidly changing intentions because of what I'm picking up. And then I then sprawl to try to not get pinned on my back. You can see how always all together, they're continually unfolding. And I think the easier way for coaches to think about it is it's like a time limitation here. Like if these were discrete steps, what I'm going to tell the fighter as he's throwing a strike, hold on a second, I need to go find this motor program and update it real quick because the information in the world's not valuable enough. Like, come on. It doesn't even make sense logically whenever you unpack the way. So I think for the coaches to think about them being intertwined together as continually evolving and feeding into one another, like Sean discussed, is the important piece here, because my intentions are going to shape how I'm picking up information, actions that are continually unfolding. And that's why in our paper and in that figure you referenced, you have those three ovals that are looping with one another. We don't view them as those discrete steps. We view them as constantly intertwined together. And my intentions may change. I may not act on an intention, but they may change dramatically within the unfolding behavior of that other in order for me to survive in that fight, in order for me to excel in that fight.
No, that's helpful. One other thing I think is often misinterpreted is this idea of decision making. And again, you mentioned the Rolodex, Sean. I think that some people perhaps reading or listening about decision making, this could imply that we're going into the Rolodex. Oh, that happened there. Which way am I going to go? Which decision am I going to make? Can you talk a little bit about decision making, why and why that shouldn't be misinterpreted as some kind of more explicit, discrete cognitive?
Yeah, the cognition from our perspective is an embodied or embedded way of coming to be. And because it is embodied and embedded, the decisions are as much about the perceptions as they are the actions. And in many cases, and in many ways, Scott, decision-making can be closely situated to that of problem-solving. We even mentioned it in that 2023 paper that is of question right now, kind of pointing back and standing on the shoulders of certain giants, such as DeWart and colleagues, when they put together the ecological cognition work in 2019. And again, that can trace back well longer ago than that. Again, Turvey was a big one that spoke to it, Michaels and Carrillo. But again, we come back to this idea of this set of capacities. Again, it could be intentions, it could be thoughts, it could be memories, it could be decisions. These capacities that are proposed to take place in the brain that we would refer to as cognition, if it's ecological, it isn't about tracing back to that Rolodex of ways of potential ways of being able to act. It's in interacting with the what is. It still is much about the functional contact with what's there. The opportunities, the challenges, the perturbations, those things that exist between oneself and the unfolding problem. And that's why cognition for us, and particularly the decision-making process, is very closely situated to problem solving, right? It's not that we go to a chalkboard, like a mathematician, writing an equation and there's only one way of acting in many of these cases, right? The way that we would propose this problem solving to take place is more highly determined based on a wide range of ways of potentially coming to be. When there is an affordance or an opportunity to act, there likely isn't channeled to just one way of acting. Now, one of those things could be a more strongly inviting us to behave in that way, and that would lead us to act in that way. It might lead us to throw that overhand because an opening was present there. But that's not the only way that we could act, right? And we also didn't find necessarily the best way. It isn't about finding the quickest decision. It's about finding the decision that matches the unfolding problem and allows us a certain degree of functionality, meaning practical, useful, resourceful. It fits the problem. And so when Tyler was mentioning Dustin Poirier jumping Gilly, like, it was functional at that moment. Now, did it lead to a successful tap out or submission? No, it didn't. But was that something that still had functionality? Like, Dustin himself got himself in a little bit of trouble from it. It led to a different exchange. But notice, like, right after the fight, he's like, I'm going to jump Gilly again, right? Because the opportunity is going to be there no matter what someone tells me on how this is my best way of acting, meaning this is the best decision to make. They're not in the octagon. I am. I'm the one that's perceiving those opportunities. And that's why we constantly in the paper, both the 2023 paper that's of question, as well as in the one that we have as featured as part of this podcast, the Applying an Ecological Approach in MMA paper, we talk about how affordances are individual and frame dependent. They are contextually situated. Those opportunities are what's right there right now in the what is. And it's up to us to make a decision or organize our action based on the perception of those affordances. And that's why it's all intertwined, interwoven, and it's hard to separate the processes from one another because they shouldn't be separated. They are always tightly coupled and feeding into one another in that way.
The only thing I want to mention on the tail end of that right there is, even if you adopt an ecological approach and you're working with said fighter, they can be poor decision makers as well if you weren't embedding them within an alive movement problem. So let's say that you are just adopting this approach and then you're seeing them unsuccessfully secure submissions or throw strikes. And you're like, well, I don't understand. I've done certain things that are aiding in this development. Maybe you're also harnessing or trying to harness maybe a more technical model IP type approach. Well, the detriment here is that the way they become a good decision maker is becoming sensitive to specifying information. Specifying information is found in those problems that look, feel, and behave like they will in the sport. You just need to, you being the practitioner, just need to look to vary the complexity of the problem to make it sometimes a little bit easier, sometimes a little bit harder. And that's where they can become more sensitive or attuned to that information, and they can effectively make decisions. But just because we say that we believe in an ecological approach, but if we didn't harness that or we didn't apply those ideas within our practice, we're likely not going to have very good decision makers within the fight itself because they're not sensitive to that information. So it's this constant coupling of oneself to the information that's specifying is what's helping develop adept fighters.
And that presumably that decision making is highly context specific. Where you are in the round, is your perception that you're ahead on points? Are you down on points? Your levels of fatigue, all these kind of things. So yeah, I think, which leads back to you talking about context being constantly embedded and extended there.
Ask body, not sorry. What you do, but where you do it. I believe that was Keith and Duarte. Ask not what you do, but where you do it. And then Sean mentioned affordances being individual and frame dependent. We talk about the importance of one's abilities matching what they've perceived as an opportunity. And that is going to be dependent on that individual, but it's not consistent throughout their lifetime. It's going to be changing based on the changing constraints. And you're going to see that, I mean, for the practitioners out there that work in facilities much like yourself, at Primal, where you've got youngsters that are coming in there, you've got even older individuals that are coming in there, but especially those youngsters, like they may shoot up 2 or 3 or 4 inches. Well, they're working with a different set of constraints now, or working within a different set of constraints. And what was possible previously may not be possible now. So if we think about it being this sport, being this problem solving activity, even though they may be a really good fighter, they're still evolving or adapting in their ability to solve those problems and having to become sensitive to information that they had perceived differently previously. So, I mean, these ideas are just important to consider whenever you are coaching, because if I'm delivering the one way to be and do, and it needs to be executed by all individuals, if they don't do it, they're wrong. I think we're really handcuffing them in a lot of ways, because they may not even perceive that as an opportunity, but we're telling them it's there. And they're like, I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't even see that. And then I saw it all the time in American football. I'm like, you didn't see that gap back to the middle? Like, no, I saw an even more inviting gap to the outside. And guess what? They may be a lot faster than I am. So they have that greater football speed. They were able to hit the boundary and pick up numerous more yardage than I would have, but I may have been looking towards the inside because I didn't have the action of capabilities to perceive an affordance that allowed me to bounce it to the outside. So I digress. But my point being is that it's a continual, ever-evolving relationship.
No, I think that's wholly relevant. And I'd like maybe to add on to that, that you spoke about earlier, Sean, the capabilities and capacities being unique to the individual themselves. I think we might have discussed it. I hope I'm fucked up the actual fight now. I think it was Cannonier versus Adesanya. And he was almost, he almost looked frozen there for a while. And we could see just by watching the TV, look at all these, it's almost we could perceive these affordances. Can you explain just from that context dependency and what was perhaps going on, why Cannonier wasn't able to exploit these? I don't believe he was seeing them, or he intuitively knew he couldn't exploit them.
Yeah, and I think this is where and why the degrees of freedom problem needs to be reframed as a more holistic one between perceptions, cognitions, and habits, right? Because we saw the actions and the motor system degrees of freedom being rigid or fixed or frozen, right? That's what we're watching as viewers, Scott. But what it led from, or what it was led from, and what it was connected to was his lack of perceptual connection, his lack of functional contact with the unfolding problem. He saw Adesanya fainting and faking in certain ways, and it led to this deception that Cannonier's like, I don't know what's there. Like, he was second-guessing his ways of acting because he actually wasn't overly attuned or sensitive to this specifying information about when Adesanya was actually going to act. But instead, Adesanya had him fixed and frozen. You and I talked about this after Adesanya fought Strickland. And in round two, when Eric Nixick goes back with Sean Strickland, he's like, you're being snake charmed by this guy. Like, he's not actually throwing anything. He's throwing nothing but feints and fakes to download his information, get his contact with the world, get his functional connection with how you're being and behaving. But there is no fire coming back at you. Like, why are you so apprehensive? Why, he's asking him, why are you so cannoneer-like in this way? Like, why are you fixed? Why are you frozen? But I think a lot of it comes down to this degrees of freedom problem being more holistic. It is dependent on the information that one is picking up, because it's that information which specifies the opportunities to act. Just like one is maybe accepting a certain affordance or opportunity to act, they will be rejecting others as well, right? They all have very different invitation strength. And there will be both simultaneous and successive affordances. Like, that affordance landscape equates to simultaneous affordances. I could do this, I could do that, I could do this over here. But ultimately, if I do this, it might lead to this action, meaning successive affordances too. And I think when you find fighters, maybe like a Jared Cannonier versus Israel Adesanya, maybe an example that we just saw a few weeks ago at UFC 299 with Kevin Holland and Michael Venom Page. Like, he's never seen somebody that's unorthodox in that way, moving in that highly authentic or novel way, that Holland's just like, what is happening right now? And it led him to have these outlandish ways of like frustration, because he didn't know what was coming and when it was coming. We saw it with Cheeto and Sugar as well in the main event, right? And these are really good examples as to how we're seeing these movement behavior concepts kind of coming to light and coming to be. And it's why it makes mixed martial arts as a whole, particularly that at the highest competitive level, to be such a fascinating case study for anyone that holds these ideas to be near and dear to their heart, because you can see them living and breathing there in the fighter cage system.
And it would be fair to say that frustration in and of itself is a perturbation to the perceptual system, right?
Yeah, I think so. I absolutely agree.
Tyler?
I was just concurring with you. Absolutely. And you can utilize some of the other thing as you were talking there, both of you. I was thinking about form of life again and how you can utilize one's form of life against them. And it's something that can channel your intentions, maybe even channel some of the things that you may attempt to do within practice. And you have different individuals that are maybe moving in ways that are similar to how the fighter that you're going to be fighting is likely going to move. And let's say it's, and the easy go-to is, and we've talked about this before, like Masvidal and Askren. You're going against one of the greatest wrestlers of all time that likely shoots on every entry into problems that they interact with. And sometimes that can be a detriment to you as well, because if you've done enough analysis on something, you've moved in a way. Now, I don't think that Masvidal, in my humble opinion, even if he tells you this is what he did, because sometimes it's hard to know what you're actually doing in real time, like may have the intentions that I'm going to execute a jumping knee here. But he was still coupling it to what Askren was doing, how he was moving, and likely saw that center of gravity drop. And as he saw that center of gravity drop and he's picking up speed and all of a sudden, nighty night out. But you use that form of life against someone, but it's constantly coupled to information. Now, I still think there's the importance to embed people in problems that are like that. And all that to say, I concur. But I think it's interesting because if we think about this constantly evolving relationship and the need to become sensitive to information, we can see the value in having someone placed within movements or problems that look, feel, and behave like the sport. And I think that even practitioners that are maybe new to this approach, they're already using some of these ideas. So maybe it's just embracing more.
Yeah, as we start to round off here, this is a question specifically for me and some of the questions I'm being asked. I have to be extremely careful with my messaging here, right? Because some people may be getting in touch. How are you implying this to us from a striking perspective? And again, going back to our earlier discussion between foundations and fundamentals, as I speak about this all the time, that I take head contact off the table immediately when in that foundational stage, because I still think we can get a lot of the foundational skills developed without the risk of injury. You guys come from American football. Can you talk about how representative is representative enough and how you maybe navigate some of these ethical concerns as it pertains to injury, both acute and chronic?
Yeah, and of course, we talk about this a number of times over the years, also in our previous podcast interviews that we've done together, Scott. And I commend you for always circling the wagons there, because it's kind of the elephant in the room when we talk about mixed martial arts, right? But it's also the elephant in the room when we talk about American football in most other contact sports, right? Even sports like soccer, that on the surface where the people aren't running into one another, they're still heading balls or they're still having inadvertent contact that occurs, where that's a part of the aliveness. In order for it to be as high of a degree of representative task design as one could possibly be. The thing that I think we need to do is always checking back the unfolding behaviors to what could unfold in the competitive environment. And we want to ensure that we're not watering it down so far for someone who might be preparing to get in a fight in a competitive stage, or in then my world on an American football field. They're not so close to training camp or preseason that we want to maybe help them to not become attuned to that information. We want to ensure that we're not getting in the way of the information that they must become coupled to in order to guide and shape their actions. A perfect example is when I see people begin to dabble in an ecological approach in American football, they do a lot of 1v1 type of interactions, like cat and mouse type games and the like. And they'll see a lot of like side to side, back and forth type of interactions. And I was there, I did that early on in 2012 and 2013. But when I began to check it back to the game, I'm like, well, wait a minute. This person isn't going to have the time or opportunity to make these types of moves when it's 11 v 11, right? I had to check those behaviors back to the game. And hence the reason I very rarely do that type of slice or snippet of the game any longer, because oftentimes the behavior that we see unfold in the practice setting or environment doesn't check back very well, right? Even with the way that in American football, one player might tag off on another one trying to simulate a tackle. They're often in a poor body position or posture where they're not able to actually carry out an actual tackle to the ground. So I have to check those behaviors back to the competitive environment and say, well, how else could we behave in the practice environment so you don't have to tackle or take that guy to the ground, but we know that the information you're becoming sensitive or attuned to and how you're attempting to adapt your actions in relation to isn't completely bastardized. Like, you're still able to become connected and coupled through your movement behaviors to the unfolding problem when you do need to tackle them. And I think that's one of the things that you do such an exceptional job of, and why I feel like it was really important for us to have that as a case study and as an exemplar in the paper, because some of your striking introductory games that are foundational allows for similar types of movement behaviors where you can take the head strikes off the table, but they are still becoming very sensitive and attuned to some informational variables that both have been recognized in research, such as interpersonal distance and that changing interpersonal distance, posture and kinematics of an opponent, maybe other information sources such as relative velocity angles and values that are taking place there. All of these types of things are rich information sources that we want the fighter, in your case, or the player, in my case, to become attuned and sensitive to. And if they're not, we're actually getting further away than we are getting closer to the game. That's why we have to go back to, does it look, feel, act, and unfold like it will and does in the game?
Okay, I see Tyler has to go here soon. So let's wrap this up. I'm going to throw a really random question out here because once you get in the space, it's the thought kind of little experiments you come up with or ideas that you have are vastly different from the traditional. I had a kid in on Saturday with a very baggy, thick hoodie on. And you mentioned the word kinematics here and they were doing the shoot box and the play and whatnot. Do you have anything to say on whether wearing these baggy clothes and whatnot when we're striking would be muffling or disguising some of the rich kinematic information? Do you think that could be either, it could be both. Do you think that's robbing that perceptual experience? Or do you think in terms of maybe making it more challenging, you're almost occluding some of that information? Do you think there's a case to be made here that could be both detrimental and beneficial? Baggy clothing that are somewhat disguising the really sensitive kind of cues and kinematics?
Yeah,
that was my question for the weekend.
Yeah, I really like where your head's at here. And I think it will do both of those things. It could amplify our search in some ways, because we will have to be on the search and sort of the problem solving or exploration process to find other relevant information sources that might tell us something about the affordances test, right? So if someone is too perceptually connected on that one informational variable, potentially shoulders and where the shoulders might be or how someone's chest or arm is positioned, and that baggier clothes would muffle that, to your point, I think it will require the performer to search for other information source. But ultimately, we want them to have access to the most relevant specifying information sources and to kind of connect the dots and put it together. It's why when we get closer and closer to the season, for the players that I partner with, and Tyler will attest to this, they're almost always behaving with their helmet on, because the helmet itself will occlude certain perceptual information that you just won't have if you don't have it on. The same thing with shoulder pads or jersey on. Like, both the ways of you acting, but also the information that you might pick up from your opponent, which is highly vital to informing one of our ways of acting. We want them to become so sensitive to that information that they're using to couple their movement behaviors in tight, close relation to it.
I think this, sorry, if you can add on to this, Tyler, the question adds on to this. Can you speak or give a couple of examples of how exceptionally sensitive we can come to this kind of information? I remember, I think it was Dr. Rob talking about some kind of cricket example where they're taping the fingers different colors of the bowler and stuff, that over time, how extraordinarily sensitive we can become to the specified information. Do you have any examples of that can just kind of, because my mind's always blown of how sensitive our perceptual system can be.
Examples within MMA or any sport?
Just anything, because it's fascinating, because this, I think, is a good message to get across. This is ultimately what we're trying to do, is become sensitive to information.
Are you talking about what we may do as coaches to illuminate what we have perceived to be specifying information and then hope to guide that individual towards it? Is that what you're referring to?
No, I'm asking, do you have any examples of how sensitive athletes can be? Like, to talk about a bowler and actually taping their fingers and the batsman being able to get information.
Yeah, utilizing
the color of the fingers is incredible to me.
Utilizing a similar type sport, like in professional baseball, well, any baseball, but in Major League Baseball, you talk to hitters, or more importantly, you see how they behave and how effective they may be against certain pitchers. And then you discuss, while looking at the movements, either in person or on video, they're going to pick up arm slot subtleties. So with the degree of flexion of their arm, or how that arm is in relation to where their shoulder is, and then even just how their fingers may be, or their wrist may be turned, because that will tell us a lot about what pitch may be coming. And so really good hitters are going to pick up those small nuances, which is information that is highly specifying, because it's how the ball may come out of the hand, the type of spin that the ball may have. So similar sport, obviously very different as far as the overall task constraints, but similar in the fact that there's a moving object that's coming at them. Or one of the classic examples, and I'm trying to think the other, I believe it was Agassi, it was in tennis. I'm trying to think who it was, but it was, they picked up, do you know what I'm talking about?
Boris Becker and the tongue, right?
Yeah, the tongue. You see where I'm going with it. So it's like certain behaviors from others that are tells, if you will, but they're specifying information of what I may need to look for. But it was like, there's always going to be a serve on certain parts of the court if there is a certain movement of the tongue. And it was just like time after time again in that situation. And that's why I think I'm going to flip this a little bit. That's why I think that deceptive movements can be so valuable. So one thing that we do within my learning environment, I know Sean and Blake do it in their learning environment, is working with our ball carriers, and that might be receivers, any type of receiver or running backs, whatever, or even quarterbacks, like what they may be able to do with their upper extremity. So not just their eyes, but definitely their eyes, but their upper extremity, to look towards a space that they may intend to move away from. So if I am looking to pick up what type of gap may be available back to the inside, because this team has greater space in between their defenders in certain coverages that they may run, and that's what we may have picked up on our movement analysis, that I may have the ball carriers look to the outside. And so the defenders picking up on not only the way in which that head's moving, because they can see the face mask, they may even be able to see their eyes. And then they start to move more laterally, which does what? It presents an opportunity for action to cut back to the inside if I have the football speed to get there. And that's that intertwined process of perceiving and cognizing and acting that are all coupled together. And so I would like to flip it and use it against them. But in doing so, we may be asking questions such as, what have you noticed about their center of mass height? Or one of the questions that we posed within the Being Water paper was, what have you noticed about the ball in relation to the server? And the reason why we use that as an example is there's certain serves that are going to require you to have the ball in different displacements. That way you can put spin on the serve versus it being just like an overhand type drive. Same could be said within badminton and other racket type sports. So that's how we might utilize a question to illuminate what we have identified collectively as really good information for them to start to become sensitive to. And the example that you gave, such as like the color on a ball and the like, there's research that shows that we can actually pick up the lateral displacement of the ball. I think it was done in volleyball. The study was, I'll have to look and see the authors. The lateral displacement of the ball more so on volleyballs that had a colored stripe on them versus one that was entirely white. And so that can mean a lot for our practice design, But just thinking about those things and thinking about questions that one may be able to ask fighters or ways in which they may be able to move deceptively. That's why I think you see like City Kickboxing, a lot of what Adesanya and others have done down there, moving in ways that are trying to draw out that behavior, or MVP in the example, Sean, you just gave from 299. Like that clearly wasn't a part of, or likely, I should say, wasn't part of the training camp of the other individual, or if so, they didn't have anywhere that anyone that moved anything like MVP, because it looked as though that was the first time he ever tried to perceive that information before.
I think that's a wonderful reminder of, I tell the guys all the time, this is a, especially in the strike, this is a reading sport. Be good at reading and be hard to read. And when we create a monoculture of fighters moving the same way, I think it just does a detriment to their overall development and their skill attunement.
Likewise, I agree.
Yeah, and I would just say, instead of using the word read, I think we should use the word perceive there, because that perceptual information is very rich. That information that is going to be most highly specifying to one might be relatively authentic too. And I think we should learn to trust what fighters are picking up, but we should allow them to be immersed in environments and alive movement problems that require and facilitate that perceptual pickup also.
The other reason those words are valuable, and Scotty, I love the idea, the notion of it, and I see where you're going with it. The other reason why I think perceive or detect, pick up, those are words that are going to help capture what's actually occurring more so, but then also feed into the design of the activities. If we utilize the word read, what do we read with? We read with our eyes. Now, J.J. Gibson argued that's probably our strongest perceptual system, but think about the sport of MMA and how important haptic information is in the sense of touch, and how important displacement within a cage is, or in other sports. We were on a call, Sean and I were, for the Movement Academy not too long ago, when we were with a higher level badminton coach. And he was talking about when they were in doubles, I believe it was, right, Sean? In doubles, where how important it was for the front individual to pick up the noise of how the individual behind him is moving. Because as that shuttlecock's being hit, he's not turning around looking to see where he is to turn back around. There's no time for that. I have to be able to hear it based on what I can pick up from behind me. So that's why I think those words are valuable. But that also can inform what questions you may ask as well. If you're working in a grappling sport and asking questions that were going to illuminate the haptic information that one may feel and how they can start to utilize leverage points against another individual.
Yeah, I do agree with you that perceive is a better word. It's just sometimes when I'm talking to my kids and my athletes, reads, I try and meet them where they are for a lot of the time. But yeah.
Appreciate you having me on, my friend. It was a lot of fun. Obviously, we went for about 45 minutes before we even hit record. So. That shouldn't be overly surprising, but greatly appreciated. And like we said on the onset of this call here, we loved having you on the paper. I think your case example is highly valuable. Greatly appreciate Andy and Adam and Keith as well. But I'm hoping that it's something that the movement community can, in particular the MMA community and certain disciplines and martial arts, can grasp onto, and they can pick something that they feel as though that they can start to utilize right away. And I think very quickly you'll find that it's going to be successful, or help aid in success of those that you work with.
And I know you need to get going. Maybe Sean can answer this after, but this was a starting point, right? You're looking to for future investigations into the sport here too, and maybe coming up with some kind of study.
Yeah, so that is something that we certainly want to do, and why I would implore the readers. Of course, it is open access. The paper is open access. So hopefully the reader's journey into some of these ideas, if any of them were intriguing, doesn't stop here once they hit stop on the podcast, or once you hit stop, Scotty. I hope readers find their way into the material also, and I will hope it involves a certain amount of inquiry. That inquiry involves curiosity. It involves them inquisitiveness, asking questions around some of the things that they know from their lived experience and how it might be able to be explained or captured in this perspective, or how it might be able to be facilitated in coaching practice more efficaciously, because this is a very constantly evolving field and body of knowledge, to your point, Scott. And I think that's why this is just the tip of the iceberg. There are so many places and directions that we're going to be able to go right here, right now, and what lies in front of us. And I think the best is yet to come. We're going to hopefully be able to shed some light on some things that allows us to actually make better decisions in our coaching practice and to allow the athletes themselves to be the product of their own learning too. Just like we hope for every reader of the paper, we hope that it doesn't stop there.
Tyler, I know you need to go here, so I just want to say thank you. Thank you for allowing me to give my modest contribution and congratulations. I really mean that. I know how hard you work on these things.
They are a lot of fun. It's a learning experience every time. And your question at the very beginning was a great one, like basically why MMA, which hopefully we covered the reasons as to why. But I think it's just the time is ripe. And so we felt as though that it needed to be done. And there are a lot of really good coaches out there that are doing some great things. And so we kind of wanted to illuminate some of those things that they were doing, and maybe also shine another light on some areas that could be improved. And not to say that we have all the answers, because we certainly don't, but we have a theory that a framework that helps back why we do what we do. And I have found as a practitioner, in particular working with American football players, that whenever I anchored what I did to something versus just randomly doing things, that I found greater success. And my athletes will tell you they actually enjoyed it more as well. So that all said, like you mentioned, Sean, more to come. And I'm excited about it. And I greatly appreciate all your efforts as well.
All right. And I'll share the links for the papers in the show notes. And if anyone wants to reach out to the boys, give them a follow on Emergence. That's Sean Mishka and Tyler Yearby. Thanks a lot, boys. Until the next time.